Well, welcome to First Response, a live teleforum and podcast from First Liberty Institute, in which we look at the impact of COVID-19, where it intersects with religious liberty. I'm Jeremy Dice, an attorney with First Liberty Institute.
And I'm Justin Butterfield, another attorney here at First Liberty.
Well, Justin, things have been definitely shifting this past week. Something feels a lot different, and it's not just that we have entered the third month in which most of the nation has been either working remotely or severely restricted in their movement.
Well, you're right, Jeremy, and while we haven't been in lockdown for a full 3 months, we are entering the third calendar month for this lengthy sequester. In fact, our first episode of First Response was March 20th, and you know, a lot's changed since then.
Yes, it has. In fact, we've gone from explaining to houses of worship across the country how they should evaluate any shelter-in-place orders by government officials to evaluating the constitutionality of things like drive-in church services. So now we're starting to think about how to reopen America's houses of worship and get back to some sense of normalcy.
That's right. And you know, the change didn't just happen on its own. In fact, I wonder how things might be different right now had churches not respectfully asserted their constitutional rights against elected officials who have sometimes acted as though the First Amendment were also in lockdown.
Well, none more so than Bill de Blasio, I suppose. But his approach has changed too, I guess, not really for the better. A few weeks ago, you'll recall, he threatened to permanently close houses of worship in New York City who didn't obey his directives. But just this week, he took to Twitter with a threat to send in the NYPD to arrest Orthodox Jewish adherents gathered in peaceful exercise of religion.
Yeah, that's right. That's really unfortunate that some government officials are stooping to that level. But, you know, at least Governor Cuomo has now ordered the New York City subway to finally be deep cleaned. But, you know, Mayor de Blasio isn't the only one who needs to be reminded about the importance of protecting religious liberty during a pandemic. This week, First Liberty took legal action against Governor Jay Inslee in the state of Washington.
Oh, that's right, Justin. But that request for a temporary restraining order wasn't for a church to hold a drive-in service or even resume in-person meetings. Tell everybody what makes that case so unique.
Sure. Well, our client, who happens to be running for governor himself, hosts regular Bible studies at his house, which he's had to put on hold during the state's shelter-in-place order. But that source of Christian fellowship and Bible study is very important to him, and even more so during the pandemic. So we asked the court on his behalf for a temporary restraining order just so that he could meet one-on-one with the members of his Bible study on the lawn outside of his house, staying 6 feet apart.
You mean he and another person would sit on lawn chairs, basically, separated by at least 6 feet to study the Bible and pray? Why would anyone oppose that?
Yeah, I don't know. And he was even going to require that his guests bring their own lawn chair so that nobody would have to touch the same lawn chair. You know, it unfortunately appears the state of Washington is actually going to challenge that request in court about a week from today. So it's looking like in Washington, you'll soon be able to go golfing and fishing with a friend, but you can't sit 6 feet away from that friend in your front yard to talk about the Bible.
Wow. Well, we'll watch that very closely, and perhaps we'll have some late-breaking news to share with everyone on First Response next week. But meanwhile, we should get to our distinguished guests for this call.
We should. In a little bit, we're hoping to have Dr. Charmaine Yost, Vice President of Heritage Foundation, where she leads the Institute for Family, Community, and Opportunity. And I believe she's going to join us to talk about a path forward for reopening America and the role the church might play in our post-coronavirus recovery.
Yes, and folks may notice that we started a little bit late to that, and that was because we haven't quite heard from Dr. Yost yet. Perhaps she'll join us on the line, and if not, we'll make sure to catch up with her later this week and bring that episode to everyone at firstliberty.org. But I'm also eager to hear from Charmaine, whether that's now or later this week. But first, I'm very pleased to introduce to everyone Dr. Albert Moeller, Jr. Dr. Moeller serves as president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky, and he is a theologian, public intellectual, author, and pastor, and you could probably add a number of other things to that list of qualifications. On top of everything else that he does from day to day, he somehow finds the time each weekday to host an analysis of news and events, as he says, from a Christian worldview on his podcast, which he calls The Briefing. It seems like Dr. Moeller is always in demand by major news media and always in service in some capacity to the church, whether that is at his local body where he fellowships, or serving in a friend's pulpit, or leading the national gatherings like the recent Together for the Gospel convention. In fact, it's because Dr. Moeller cares so deeply for the local church that we have asked him on the show today. So, Dr. Moeller, thank you so much for joining us on First Response.
Jeremy, it's a real privilege to join with you and with Justin and with all those who are participating on this call and will be hearing. These are important issues. I'm really glad to have the conversation with you.
Well, we're looking forward to a great conversation. You know, as we discussed before coming on the show, Dr. Mulder, we're eager to get your thoughts about what the elders and deacons and church leaders ought to be considering as they plan to reopen their facilities. But I sense we need to lay a little foundation before we get into that part of the conversation. A few weeks ago, you and my boss, Kelly Shackelford, wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post making the case that it was prudent to temporarily suspend in-person church services as requested by the state, but that state officials should be measured in those requests. Help us understand how you arrived at that kind of thinking. In this and other situations, how should churches evaluate requests or even demands by the state that directly impact the local church?
Well, that gets right back to our first liberty, which is the very name of your organization. Religious liberty requires our constant vigilance, and not just because we believe it is a political right, but because we believe it's a natural right given to us by our Creator. And as Christians, we believe that our first responsibility is to worship and acknowledge the one true and living God and Jesus Christ, whom He has sent. And so the priority of the church being the church is prior for Christians to the priority of the state being the state. However, we are leftist citizens of both a heavenly and an earthly kingdom, so to speak, and the Christian church through two millennia has been really serious about thinking about what that responsibility means. And so, you know, the argument that that I made along with Kelly in the Washington Post is that Christian churches in a time of emergency such as the pandemic should respond graciously and respectfully to the rightful role of government in making generally applicable orders. And the problems come either when there is no legitimate emergency or when those orders are not generally applicable. And that means the church is not singled out or religious assemblies are not singled out. And even in your conversation today, you guys have already indicated that that's just not the case across the country. Even here in the Commonwealth of Kentucky, our governor early in the pandemic issued an order that churches or it was a very strongly worded policy statement that churches should not gather together for worship on the Lord's Day. At the same time, at that point, he was allowing high school basketball games to go forward or any other assembly. And so I immediately protested and said, this is unconstitutional, and the church has no regard for a targeted do not assemble order. Now, to his credit, or at least recovery, 24 hours later, the governor changed it to a generally applicable rule. But that is the key issue. And so I've called along with Kelly Shackelford and you guys at First Liberty and others and publicly done so to say churches ought to respect those legitimate, generally applicable requests. But where there are targeted and unconstitutional abrogations and limitations on religious liberty, then we have to speak up not just for our own assemblies, but for each other.
And Dr. Mulder, I think those are all great points. And, you know, it raises a point that so many of these issues have been coming up where they're not just wanting churches to follow the same rules as everybody else. They're actually wanting churches to be restricted more than others. And it makes me think we've had to file a lawsuit in Greenville, Mississippi recently. And in the mayor's announcing that he was stopping drive-in churches in Greenville, he actually had a press conference where he stood at the front with 20 reporters in attendance, and he spoke to them about why it was so dangerous for churches to have drive-in church services while he was having the equivalent of an in-person service just under the name of a press conference instead of church service.
The other problem I have seen is where you've got state officials using the language of essential and non-essential and applying that to any kind of religious observance or service. And that to me is just way over the line. It's absolutely unnecessary, by the way, in any general application of a policy. It's the kind of language that you would think politicians and government officials would have enough sense to stay away from when it comes to religious bodies.
I absolutely agree. You've studied a lot of church history, and I think it'd be helpful if you could kind of set the context for why the Christian church has historically gathered in person and what it is about in-person worship and prayer that is so important.
It's the very essence of the church in this age, you know, and by the way, it's the essence of the church in the age to come, which is even referred to in the New Testament as the assembly. So we'll be assembled all together at one point. all those who are in Christ. That's a cardinal point of Christian doctrine. But you know, as early as the disciples gathering together after the crucifixion of Christ, you have the gathering together continually. And of course, after the resurrection, in Acts chapter 2, you have the record that the first thing that the early Christians did was to under the leadership of the apostles, gather together for fellowship, for the breaking of bread and the prayers, and of course preaching. And then you even had admonition, such as in the book of Hebrews, chapter 10, where we are told that that faithful Christians don't neglect to meet together, but rather do so, meeting together, encouraging one another, and all the more, as the writer of Hebrews tells us, as we see the day drawing near. And then all these other references you have, I won't go through text by text, that are just making very clear that the church is a gathered community. And you know, that by the way, just as a little footnote in history, that's the very language borrowed from Protestant Christianity that, for instance, the Pilgrims used as they were describing even the society that they were establishing in the New World, as they called it. So, you know, for here in the United States, it's not just our tradition of constitutional order. It's also our long national tradition of understanding the priority of religious assembly.
That's a fascinating and helpful history, but I want to shift now to the present, if we could. The worst of the virus, I think maybe for now, seems to be passing. Normalcy, while it's still somewhere in the distance, seems to be something we can at least now begin to imagine again. The elders and deacons of my church, for instance, have begun thinking through when and how to resume in-person services, and I'm sure many others have as well. But they, along with, I'm sure, many that are listening today, I suspect could really use your guidance in particular. How do we think through this? What are the critical elements to consider in that process of reopening?
You know, I think one critical issue is understanding that the best advisement we have right now is that it's not a matter of flipping a switch from off to on, in which case we just say everything's now back to normal. It's like it's the first Sunday in February. And so everyone who wants to come can come. You can sit, you know, in the pew right next to someone, and that's not likely to happen immediately. And we long for it to happen. But the best thinking that that I'm aware of and involved with, for instance, in the Southern Baptist Convention, and amongst other evangelicals and Christians, is that it's going to have to be a phased process, and we're going to have to take seriously the fact that the last thing we want to do is for any one of our congregations to become a vector for new contagion of COVID-19 and the coronavirus. So it's going to require a lot of very careful thinking. And I think there's some principles that would apply nationwide, but given the fact that this is a regional issue, state by state, even community by community, it's going to take a lot of really keen Christian thinking, congregation by congregation. Look, I'll tell you one of the most interesting questions, difficult questions that has come up right now is, how do you tell people we can have 10 people in worship this Sunday and maybe 20 the next Sunday and 30 the next Sunday? You know, who decides that? And how do we arrange people sitting together? Do families sit together? That their households already? But then how much spacing between? Difficult questions. How do you have restroom facilities or anything else? We're going to learn together with other organizations. I think that's important to understand, and that would include schools and businesses. Just what are best practices for cleaning and for distancing until we can be free of that concern. So right now, it reminds me of the biblical phrase. You know, this is going to come by fear and trembling, but I think it also means that pastors and Christian leaders in a community really need to be talking to one another and at least sharing the best wisdom that they can that they can determine amongst themselves.
Well, that's a very insightful discussion, Dr. Moeller. And let me ask you one final question before we let you go. You know, it's entirely possible that this virus will return either, you know, in this fall or next year. And if it does, it may even do so more forcefully. What do you think that the church should have learned in terms of its importance to the local community, the central nature of religious liberty, or something else from this round of the virus that we should be more prepared for next time if we have to face it again?
Well, you know, I think one thing that just about all of us recognize is that there are lessons from this that we're going to carry over after, and boy, do we pray there's a soon after the coronavirus crisis or this crisis. And that is, there are things we're going to learn about sanitation and cleaning and such that are going to carry over. I think the other thing we need to recognize is that we really do honor the role of government, Romans 13. Function of government. And government does have a responsibility to protect the people. And so I think we're going to really hope and pray and urge that our political leaders and government will be better prepared next time and more quickly responsive. There's human nature that comes into this, because when you had the SARS epidemic, even the swine flu, and I'm old enough to remember all these, especially the swine flu epidemic, when it wasn't as bad as some medical authorities warned that it would be, there was kind of a stand down. And so many people said, well, we're not going to take this seriously. I think it's really clear that from now on, if someone coughs across the Pacific, Americans are going to take notice.
That's a good way to put it, and a good place to end our conversation. Dr. Mohler, you and I have spent many, many miles together as I've worked out in the morning listening to you on the briefing, and I'm sure many others on the call have benefited from your wisdom over the years as well. Thank you for helping us think through this important issue and for your continued leadership of the church. And thanks for joining us today on First Response.
Jeremy, it's been a privilege, and thank you for all you and your colleagues do to defend religious liberty in the United States. And God bless you.
Well, thank you. Well, Justin, I think there's a lot to think through when considering reopening in-person church services, something from, everything from state recommendations to medical advice to measuring the amount of personal protective equipment we may have or actually have need for as we do. One thing is certain is that churches and houses of worship are going to be important for the future of the United States.
Well, as they have been throughout our history, of course. And, you know, it's important for us to remember that this virtual environment is not normal. Our founders structured our country from the very beginning, as Dr. Mohler referenced, to provide ample space for religion to be exercised. The American brand of religious liberty contemplates religion in everyday life, free of control or direction by the government. Of course, as we've observed over the past few weeks, in times of extreme crises, there may be good reason to place temporary restrictions on that, but that must not be indefinite or overly intrusive.
That's right. And I think that that's the change in the air that we're beginning to feel right now. It seems like the country can sense that there are some who would actually make these changes indefinite or maybe even permanent. And the more they try to claim that these are temporary measures, the less that they seem to be believed, especially when they see repeated examples of overreach, as we've seen in Kentucky or Mississippi, New York, Washington, Illinois, and I'm sure there are many other cases around the country. At least I can say this with some comfort. It's good to see that the American people, while cautious, remain uncomfortable with the current status quo. All right, Justin, let's turn now to our next guest, Charmaine Yost from the Heritage Foundation.
Charmaine, thank you for joining us. As Vice President for Heritage Foundation, Dr. Yost directs work on domestic policy issues, including health care and welfare reform, education policy, civil society, and religious liberty. She previously served in the White House in the Office of National Drug Control Policy and as an Assistant Secretary in the Department of Health and Human Services. Dr. Yost received her bachelor's degree in political science from Wheaton College. Later, she earned a master's and a doctorate from the Department of Politics at the University of Virginia, where she received Mellon, Olin, Bradley, and Kohler fellowships. Dr. Yost and her husband are the parents of five children. Their oldest three children have been Division I athletes and include an NCAA champion, four-time ACC champion, and a CAA champion. Their son is an Army officer and Black Hawk pilot. Dr. Yost, welcome to First Response.
Well, thanks for having me. It's good to be with you today.
Dr. Yost, one of the things I most respect about the Heritage Foundation is its consistent ability to turn out both thoughtful and practical guidance on difficult topics. Dr. Mohler just helped us think through how churches can begin to reopen and how the leaders of our houses of worship wade through these difficult topics. But let's pull back a little farther from individual churches and to the broader recovery effort. What role might the country's churches and houses of worship play in the overall recovery of our communities and nation?
Well, already we're seeing that churches are essential to the recovery process, although I wouldn't really skip over the, you know, we're still in the midst of this unprecedented crisis, and I wouldn't skip over the role that churches are playing even in the midst of it, to recovery. What you're seeing is just kind of a renewed recognition, I think, of how essential worship and community and pulling together and the role that the church plays in that. It's been really inspiring to me to see how many churches have been using technology in really creative ways to bring their church families together and to continue to have a sense of worship communally. Because, you know, as Al Mohler said, that is at the essence and the heart of the church, is being together in worship. And so as people are struggling to find their footing and their emotional response to this kind of crisis, it's been essential for the church to have that kind of outreach. And that's only going to intensify as we move forward into the recovery phase. You know, it's interesting when you think back over the history of these kinds of plagues, if you will. The church has always been there and continuing today. You know, I follow Samaritan's Purse, for example, on Instagram, and the constant stream of the pictures of the service that they are providing in New York City, having built a mobile hospital right there in Central Park. You know, that's the kind of response that we've come to expect and just assume is going to be there from the church, because the church always has been.
Well, Charmaine, your career has taken you in and out of the private sector and in public service as well. It's clear that both will have to cooperate if we are to make a full recovery once we get through this entire pandemic. How does that actually work out? How do we respect freedom and personal responsibility while making sure we keep a careful eye on the public health?
Right. So let me tie into some of the things that Dr. Mohler was saying about. He did a really good job of outlining how churches can be thinking about reopening. One of the things that I personally have been involved in, the president of Heritage Foundation, Kate Cole James, has convened a commission called the National Commission on Coronavirus Recovery. And your listeners can find out more by going to coronaviruscommission.com. And there's a place there on that website for people to leave their own stories and to communicate with the commission, because the role of the commission and the reason that Mrs. James brought the commission together was to look forward toward a time of recovery and to find ways to knit together the two elements that you just mentioned, both our lives and our livelihoods. And I would, in the context of this conversation, I would include our spiritual livelihood in that, because, you know, we're worried about how people go back to work, but at the same time, there's that parallel concern of how do we open back up our communal lives in terms of our communities. But you can't leave the concern for human life by the wayside, right? As people of faith, that's always going to be a primary concern of ours. And so what the commission has been saying in terms of looking at the workplace, and I would say that this applies exactly the same to churches, is that the United States is a very, very large country. We have states that are the same size as countries in Europe. And so there's not a one-size-fits-all recommendation, and exactly the same is true of churches. Where you have large and small work communities, you also have large and small church communities. And so you have to look very close to the ground in terms of what are the different conditions that you have. You know, do you have a large number of cases in your community? Are the cases increasing or decreasing? And so you can, from a macro level, you can look at some of these larger trends, but then it comes down to, as you move forward prudentially and wisely and humbly, we've all learned so much about what a real appropriate public health response looks like. And so being your neighbor's keeper means taking personal responsibility for, you know, as our churches open back up, maybe your church is all going to come together and agree that you're wearing the masks, that you're not passing the peace, you're praying for one another, but maintaining appropriate distance. So there's things that you can do to maintain freedom, but also be wise at the same time. You know, isn't that what Scripture calls us to be gentle as doves, but wise as serpents? And so I see that as applying here in the situation that we don't give up our freedoms, but we marry our freedoms together with personal responsibility.
Dr. Yost, you wrote a little while ago that once the totalitarian impulse is tolerated and cloaked in sanctimony, its targets will be far-ranging. Of course, that was in the context of free speech and what we might call cancel culture. And I would probably stop short of labeling the overreaches that we've seen recently as totalitarian. But this virus seems to reveal that we still have sort of an authoritarian streak among some elements within the government. I was wondering, what have we learned about our country's commitment to freedom and personal responsibility these last 7 or 8 weeks as we've seen sort of that conflict play out?
Well, I'm glad to hear you lay this situation out in what I consider to be a measured way. I think it's important to recognize that there are always going to be threats to our freedoms. And, you know, our founders talked about eternal vigilance in defending our freedoms, but also recognizing that that we need to be sober and recognize that there's an appropriate role for government calling us to corporate responsibility in responding to this crisis. I also think it's reassuring that we got a letter from the Attorney General saying that responses to this crisis are appropriate in most cases, but that they can't overreach. That if he was very, very clear in stating that if you're opening up movie theaters and drive-in theaters, then there's no reason why a church can't do something similar, that a church must be treated in the same way as other public gathering places. You know, that's encouraging, and that, you know, hearing that from our top law enforcement official in the United States is refreshing and underscores that that freedom of speech is our first liberty, right? That these issues that you and I care about so much are being protected by our Attorney General. That doesn't mean that there aren't some overreaches. And, you know, even as we look at churches using social media effectively to worship, we can also use our increased technologically equipped abilities to communicate to help people have a way of redress and to publicize cases where perhaps, you know, we heard Mayor de Blasio saying he was talking about permanently shutting down churches. Well, there was a huge backlash to that because we were able to publicize it and make sure that people knew that that was an absolutely inappropriate thing to say. And we're also seeing internationally the example coming from China of how important our liberties are and how important it is to be vigilant in defending them. Some of my colleagues at Heritage have written some really interesting papers about the absolute vacuum and in China of a vibrant civil society and how damaging that has been to them in their public response to this. And, you know, we frequently think of the Chinese clamping down on freedoms in an aggressive sense politically, but I don't know if people are as aware of how aggressive China is in clamping down on civil society. Just the things that we kind of take for granted, like the ability of Samaritan's Purse to go out and respond to the crisis. In China, they don't have the same kinds of civil society organizations that we do because they have to register with the government and coordinate with the government. And, you know, it's essential that that we continue to recognize that that's a really vital and critical part of our culture.
Indeed it is. And that was an excellent survey of things. I want to just bring you to one last question before we let you go about your business today, Dr. Yost. You heard the conversation Justin and I were having before we started your questions about how abnormal all of this is and has been. Religious freedom is perhaps our most important freedom, but it's only one essential aspect of our overall concept of freedom. And you've alluded to some of that already. But I want you to look out ahead, maybe 6 months or a year from now, 18 months even. What might we have grown to appreciate about the American vision of freedom and especially religious freedom, having lived through this experience in 18 or 6 months from now?
Wow, what a great question, because I think I think it is important to look forward, and I think it's important to think positively about what we're moving toward, not just what we're in the midst of. And I've seen a lot of people talking about how, you know, what is it that we're going to keep? What is it that we're going to give up as we move forward? And I've even seen some people speculating that this is going to be extremely damaging to the church because people will have gotten out of the habit of going to church and to assembling together. I think that's a valid concern and something that we as people of faith need to be looking at. But I think we should look at it in the context of the fact that believing that God can also use this moment to really grow the church and inspire the church in both outreach, but also finding ways to use our freedom and to appreciate the fact when we are able to gather together again to have a greater sense of understanding how important that is to us and what community means for people of faith. I'm always going to be an optimist, and I look at this and think that we're going to come out on the other side stronger and more focused on the importance of gathering together.
Well, Dr. Yost, thank you for helping us think through the importance of the church and faith community, both presently in the midst of the pandemic, as well as we head into what we all hope will be a full recovery and a national recommitment to freedom. And thank you for joining us today on First Response.
Well, thanks for having this important program.
Well, Justin, these were deeply helpful conversations to have had. I'm eager to see how the next few weeks play out, and not just because I'm eager to get out of my house.
I know what you mean. I hope that the worst is behind us, both in terms of the virus and in terms of overreach by some government officials responding to that virus. But as we've observed before, whether in good times or bad, the Constitution still controls in this country. And that, along with our commitment to self-governance, secures our freedom and our religious freedom.
Indeed it does. Well, I think that's where we'll have to leave it for today, Justin. I'm grateful to have had this conversation with two individuals I highly admire and look forward to next week when, pending any schedule changes or other interruptions, Senator Ted Cruz will join us.
And as a native Texan, I'm eager for that conversation as well. And I hope everyone will join us next week at the same time, same number, or same podcast if you listen that way. And I also hope everyone listening will go to firstliberty.org to read the guidance that we posted there for churches considering how to resume in-person religious meetings once again.
That's a good thought. And I'll remind folks that we posted a link along with last week's podcast to some new guidance that Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, a past guest on this show, he has issued for churches hoping to restart in-person meetings as well. That's a beneficial resource some may want to check out in addition to the other resources we have for you at firstliberty.org. And let me remind everyone that First Response is also available for subscription at iTunes and Google Podcasts.
Yes, please go to iTunes and rate this podcast and maybe drop a supportive comment or two as well. Until next week, I'm Justin Butterfield.
And I'm Jeremy Dice. Thank you for listening. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week.